You're listening to Speak Free with Simon O'Connor, right here on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Well, I'm joined now by a man I hope needs no introduction. It's Jonathan Ayling. He's the head of the Chief Executive Office, the Big Deal, who runs the Free Speech Union. Jonathan, great to have you on the show.
Pleasure to talk with you again, Simon.
Look, I have to put it out there to listeners. Jonathan and I have known each other for quite some time, and I was absolutely delighted when he took over. Led, not so much took over. You've taken the leadership of the Free Speech Union, and look, thanks for the advocacy you leading. You're everywhere.
We're unfortunately very busy, and I often say I just wish every day that by the end of our day that we've come to a point where I can resign, that our team can knock off and I can go back to utter obscurity. But unfortunately, it seems the more we work in the space, the more we're provoking the hornet's nest of censorship. And it's coming to a head, I think, at the moment, Simon. There's a lot of people awaking to the stakes that are at play, that if we're not free to speak, the whole raft of many important issues that we care about suddenly become very endangered.
I was saying this to Toby Young the other day, so obviously the head of the Free Speech Union in the UK. And first and foremost, thanks to you and the team here in New Zealand bringing him out. But I said it was sort of unfortunate to use that word, that he and I had to compare notes about free speech, because you would hope that most fundamental pillar of democracy would be respected. But it's under challenge, and there's a few topics we're wanting to touch on this morning, from some new suggestions, guidance, if you will, that's been put out by the United Nations. We'll start
guidance
there.
Guidance in inverted quotes.
In inverted quotes, absolutely. They call it their Global Principles of Information Integrity. So we'll start with the UN, but we're also going to come local and talk about some of our universities and the mischief they're up to. Obviously, Chloe Swarbrick and her screaming, the river to the sea at Parliament. And obviously, you've had some success with one of the local councils. So quite a bit to cover. But starting with the UN, because about a week or so ago, I was on LinkedIn and I saw a post that someone had shared. I want to stress that to listeners, I don't follow this guy. But Antonio Guterres, the Secretary General. And he starts by saying the spread of hatred and lies online is causing grave harm, misinformation, disinformation, hate speech. But then he goes on, Jonathan, to then say, but, you know, freedom of speech and opinion is important. And I suppose I know it's very broad and a lot of our listeners won't have read it, but here's another elite, if you will, or the guy leading our UN, on one hand talking about the misinformation, the disinformation, lies, and then on the other hand, is saying free speech. I mean, those are mutually exclusive, aren't they?
Well, I think part of what leads to so much momentum around these issues is that from a 30,000-foot level in the abstract, who wants to stand up for hate? Who wants to stand up for lies? I don't believe in lies. I don't believe in hate. Of course we object to misinformation then. Of course we object to hate speech. So in the abstract, it's very easy for people in their day-to-day lives who, thank goodness not everyone sits around like you and me, Simon, thinking about these issues endlessly. Some people are actually out there living real lives, and they don't want to be hateful people. They don't want to be misinformed. And so thankfully, they do care about these issues. The problem, and I guess it plays into the other issues we'll be discussing today as well, is who gets to define these terms and what's the agenda that they have. And it's not really a question of this being about the UN and this being Guterres, or the fact that when he was Prime Minister of Portugal, he was a left-wing socialist. It's not a left-right issue. It's just the fact that whoever gets to define the rules of what is and isn't hate speech, or what is and isn't misinformation, is going to do that according to their framework and their value structure. And in reality, our value structures, our frameworks, our worldviews are very diverse nowadays. There's a lot of very basic principles that are not agreed on anymore. And so when I hear people talking about a desire for, you know, a truthful, respectful internet, I mean, who could disagree with that? But what I see underneath that is someone who's actually wanting to wield quite a big rod to beat the backs of those who disagree with him. And they may beat the backs with the very best intentions. I think it was C.S. Lewis who said, no one should be more feared than the authoritarian who does so for your own good. Because ultimately, anything that they do is justified because it's for the good of the very people that they're really subjugating. And I think there is this very elitist, very moralizing, almost, if we can put it this way, a pseudo-religious way of viewing this, that for the good of the great unwashed and the common man, we will wield our holy power to protect them. And I think that's why we should be very suspicious of this, because history is replete with examples of regimes and of individuals, and many, if you're being charitable, could be said to have had the very best intentions, but that doesn't stop the very worst of outcomes occurring nonetheless.
Yeah, when I saw this post and then obviously followed it up to read the document a bit further, alarm bells started ringing for me for many of the reasons you just touched on. And for listeners to understand, it is replete, as Jonathan said, with many noble ideas. We do want to live in a world where people get on well and can agree amicably on topics. But in reality, it's always been fraught, which is one of the reasons we have free speech, to actually debate and discuss. But I thought it was just so highly political what he was his writing, because he talks about, well, we need to protect science. You know, well, that's often up for dispute rather than singular. Facts, he says, we have to protect facts. It's like, okay, who gets to decide those? Talks about human rights. Go, yeah, well, which ones? Public health. Well, of course, we've gone through quite a bit of controversy the last few years around that. And then he adds in climate action, because of all the things, I'm showing my bias, but I think it illustrates his, of all the topics in the world, it's like, that's one of the reasons you need to control speech. You're going, this just again feels highly political, and if I might use the word elite, it's playing into that C.S. Lewis quote, that they're doing this, what they believe for our good, but in many ways, Jonathan, without our permission.
That's right. And I remember, Simon, when you and I were working alongside each other, you were a member of parliament, I was a lowly staffer, but I remember...
We were young and free.
They were simpler times now. And the Debbie Francis review came out. I think this was probably about 2019. This was a review in Parliament around a culture that I think you've spoken about there. Frankly, the culture between staff and between MPs and staff was not always what it should have been in Parliament. And I remember there was the suggestion that perhaps MPs should have to account to a code of conduct. And I remember you saying, no, it will just be used as a stick to beat the backs of the unorthodox. And my thought was, why on earth would an MP not want to sign up a code of conduct that they won't treat their staff well? And it becomes very clear. The Free Speech Union, for example, just did a bunch of polling with local councils, and local councils do have to sign up to a code of conduct. And we asked them if they thought codes of conduct were weaponized to silence the speech of local representatives. And about 55% of councillors said that at least occasionally, or over 25% said either frequently or constantly, codes of conduct are weaponized to silence local politicians' speech. And I think that's true, whether it's a code of conduct in Parliament or a code of conduct in different spaces. What's the UN calling this? These principles of online speech. I think it amounts to the same thing. It's a way of categorizing those who are in and those who are out, and then castigating the sinner in our midst who's daring to think things and express those thoughts that are out of step with the orthodox and the prevailing views. And I don't want to get too philosophical here, Simon, but I know that your listeners are well-informed, intelligent, erudite people, and so I think they're up to this contribution as well. And it's one of those basic questions of, do we want society and the individuals in our communities, do we want them to be good? And of course we do. Who doesn't want goodness in a society? But what we often forget, and what is entirely out of step with authoritarians, is that you cannot be good unless you are free. And so we have to be free before we can be good. And if we are free, we might choose not to be good. And so for the issue that animates me most especially, we cannot have informed conversations. We cannot have the development of knowledge and the pursuit of truth. These are the goods that I'm suggesting there, unless we have free speech. But if we have free speech, of course there will be people who choose to use that free speech in hateful ways or choose to use free speech to spread lies. Ultimately, our desire should be for the good of community, but we can only have that if we are free to not be good. And then we reveal who the idiotic or who the malicious is in our society. And that's, I wrote in an op-ed for Stuff earlier last week. Free speech does two things very, very well. And the first is the most noble. It enables that pursuit of truth. But sometimes people don't use free speech in a way that pursues truth, and at least it does the second thing really well at that point. It lets us see who the nincompoops are in our society, and at times there's more than we would like to admit.
I think there's the word for the day on the radio show, nincompoop. I haven't heard that for a while, but it sums it up, and it's my worry as we sort of draw a line under the UN question that it's all wrapped up a little bit like those codes of conduct in Parliament with very noble language. Who would not want to protect people from nasty people, be that, you know, in the UN's mind or in the Debbie Francis review. But on the flip side, you know, again, reading Gutierrez stuff, it's all full of the word control, and they want to control things. And it's not as much for comment, but, you know, at one point he says they want to elevate the voices of young people. And don't get me wrong, I think that's a great noble idea, but you go, that's still a political idea. Why that group over another? And here's the UN deciding it. But anyway, that feeds into the wider dynamics of it. I keep coming to those notions of elites, these big groups, often transnational, that are telling us what to do. But more locally, locally.
If we can segue from there to another issue that you would want to talk about, Simon, around comments by Chloe Schwarbrick. And I think one of the things that concerns me the most about these noble endeavors is that it creates authority that is relegated often not into the hands of people who will use it wisely and prudently and with reservation, but it attracts the very worst in our society. And I promise, if it's like a honeypot, if you create these big bats to beat down the hateful or the misled in our society, it never attracts those who will use these judiciously. It attracts the most hypocritical and the most malicious in our society. And that's the thing. I would have far more time for these noble aspirations, which I think some genuinely hold, if we didn't consistently see such rank hypocrisy exercised by the very people who are calling the loudest for these restrictions. And I think Chloe Schwarbrick is an example of this, case in point. She is insistent that she should be allowed to lead the chant from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. And I stand with her right to do that. She should be allowed to. And this will aggravate or perhaps even enrage some of your listeners. I'm not unaware of the depth of feeling on this issue. Incitement to violence is not protected by free speech. And the chant can get very close at times to incitement to violence, but it doesn't cross that line, in my opinion. And we have to be self-aware as also to make sure that incitement to violence is a high standard that is objective, that is not manipulated by our own biases, so that it really is an area that we do not accept free speech allows. But Chloe Schwarbrick should be allowed to say this, but she is also the person who has been at the forefront of leading an attempt to expand the criminalization of chants very much like this. And so should Chloe Schwarbrick be locked up for 3 years, which is the penalty for under hate speech law, for leading this chant? No. Are many in our communities, though, particularly in the Jewish community, interpreting this chant as indisputably hateful? Absolutely. And this is where we see Chloe would love to be able to use this bat to knock on every opinion and expression that she thinks victimizes or marginalizes certain communities. But as soon as she wants to express what she would consider some truth in this space, she says, well, lean into that discomfort. If you find it as a hateful expression, maybe you need to reflect on that. And, you know, maybe she's right. But it just shows that these are not the people we should be expecting to use this judiciously.
So in a strange way, we should sort of be grateful to the Chloes of the world because they are so obviously hypocritical. If it puts you slightly at ease, I actually agree with you that she does have the right to say it. I do find it exceptionally offensive. I think for what it's worth, I think it comes really close to that inciting the violence, because about 99% of people, and I've written this on a Substack this week, you know, almost 99% of people know what this chant really means, to basically wipe out a people. But it's so closely balanced for what, you know, to use her term, I'd prefer to lean into the free speech side. So, okay, you can say it and then we'll critique it. But you're dead right. She believes that she can stand on the steps of Parliament, scream this out at people, rallying them to her cause. But if I or you were to use the wrong pronouns, for example, she'd have no problem with us being in the slammer for 3+ years. And you're going, how do you reconcile this? And of course, she can't.
No, that's exactly right. And so in very basic terms, they are hypocrites. And that's why we should not trust them. But I don't know if there is an authority that I could name that we should trust to get to decide which of these opinions is truly hateful and which is harmful and which is just uncomfortable but should be allowed. The Brandeis case, which is a 1920s Supreme Court case in the United States, is the jurisprudence that the Free Speech Union looks at when we say, okay, what does incitement to violence look like? And it requires at least two tests, and it's imminence and capacity. And so as Chloe Swarbrick is standing on the steps of Parliament crying from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free, is it likely that out of that the crowd is imminently, so directly out of that case, gonna go and kill a Jew or kill an Israeli? And do they have the capacity there? Are they there with guns? Are they there with knives? Are they there with rocks to be able to enact that and that violence? That's why I don't think it is the case. And I think the point that you're making, Simon, is that we should lean into the free speech in order to critique it. The question I have for so many who very rightly point out the despicable nature of expression of this kind, and my day is full of seeing all sorts of very despicable, condemnable, repugnant ideas that I don't think we should censor. Not because, and I really hope your listeners will hear me when I say this, not because for a moment do I have any time for any of these ideas, but because I'm unconvinced, or rather quite convinced of the contrary, that censorship will do anything productive to address it. Why would we want to give Chloe Swarbrick the valorization of having been censored?
Make her a martyr. She'd love to be made a martyr.
That's right. And quite often, mainstream journalists will ask me, well, surely you wouldn't stand up for the speech rights of Hitler. Surely hate speech laws should apply to him. And I say, well, they did. They did apply to him, and they didn't work. The Weimar Republic, which existed before Hitler, had very strong hate speech laws that condemned him and condemned many of his counterparts, that locked them up for it. And what Goebbels did, Joseph Goebbels, the chief propagandist for the Nazis, he said, what is it that Herr Hitler is saying that they don't want you to hear? And they created this desirability out of these repugnant ideas. And we would do exactly the same with other ideas that we censor. We should allow them to be expressed and stand up for them to be exposed, not because we want others to believe them, but because we believe they are so self-evidently condemnable. We trust our fellow citizens to see that.
Well, that's exactly it. It is a trust element. So continuing down the local line, we've had a few issues. Well, we continue to have issues at our universities. I'm following in particular Auckland University, hasn't got a draft policy about freedom of expression and academic freedom. And long and short, it's trying to say that the university, if you will, the structure, the administration holds all those rights and the academics must fall in line. I assume the Free Speech Union would be more... This is going to be ineloquently put, more down my line of thinking, or maybe I'm in your line of thinking, which is it's the individual academics themselves who have the right and the obligation to speak freely and not be actually constrained. But your thoughts on what's happening in that space, particularly with Auckland, but I know there's issues at Vic Uni, there's issues at Massey. Talk us through them.
Well, if you'll allow me a moment, Simon, I talk of two fatalities that has led us to the space. And it took me some time, a number of years working in this role, to be able to put forward an answer as to how have we got into this place? How in just a few short decades has the West, and particularly the English-speaking West, abandon so wholesale the founding values of our society. And our society is built on so much more than free speech, but free speech is at the foundation of it, that individuals should be free to think and express their beliefs without punishment or fear. And there's two deaths that I speak of. In the 1920s, so about 100 years ago, a new generation of Marxists came on board, and they were the generation following Karl Marx. And they had been told that the proletariat would rise up against the bourgeoisie, and that an economic utopia would come into play. And they hadn't seen it happen. And a number of neo-Marxists came together. That was their term, not mine. And they got together at an Institute of Critical Studies, is what it's called, in Frankfurt, Germany. And there were a number of other others working in a similar space. But this is where individuals like Horkheimer and Mesmer began to develop ideas around cultural Marxism. And again, their term, not mine, that said, we need to attach ourselves to the universities and to the media and to the politics and to the schools of the society. As we embed our values in those locations, then the economic utopia will come. Then the proletariat will be able to overthrow the bourgeoisie. This must be not an economic mission, but a cultural mission. And this is what over time led to a phrase I'm sure your listeners will be familiar with that Dietzsche coined, called the Long March Through the Institutions. And if we step one generation further there, we then came to the 1960s, where the French philosophers, particularly Jean-François Lyotard and Michel Foucault, began to reject this idea that there was any meta-narrative, any truth, that we were all just under our own truth, and that there was nothing really objective about our common experience. And so, on the one hand, you had the death of the individual. The neo-Marxist perspective insists that we are not defined as individuals, that society is not animated by individuals, but by groups, by collectives, that our collective identity is primary, and that you and I, as straight white men, are defined by that more than we are by our own lived experience in any way. And then equally, a lesbian Maori woman is defined by that. And if she disagrees with a supposedly Maori version of what the treaty means, or a supposedly Maori version of what colonialization means, she's then the wrong type of Maori. And so this is why we now have in Parliament people saying you're a waste of Maori blood, not because of necessarily only animosity towards the Deputy Prime Minister, but because of a collective worldview that is set in, that they no longer see individuals, but they see collectives. So the first fatality, the first death, is the death of the individual, and the second is the death of truth. And free speech has nothing to offer us if it isn't a pursuit of truth. If truth doesn't exist anymore, if it's simply a combination of who has power and who's trying to get power and who's exercising power, then truth is not a noble pursuit anymore. It's a self-serving interest to try and impose ourselves on each other. It's a little bit of a long-winded way to get back to your question about the universities, though, but I think those two fatalities are really important to keep in mind. Without the individual, if collectives now reign supreme, and without truth, if it's simply a question of who has power and who is imposing themselves on others, our universities actually no longer exist in the same context that lead to them being critical institutions in our society. They existed to help be the critic and conscience of society, and to help us discern a path forward on complex issues, whether that be in the social sciences or in the hard sciences, in our legal framework, in our humanities, whatever that is. Experts were invited to come and spend lives researching intimate questions to be able to contribute and to compete and to throw their various perspectives into the marketplace of ideas, where they would be able to sort facts from error, and our society would develop as a way forward. What we see now are these perspectives of collectivism and group identity and the absence of truth and no true meta-narrative applying, corrupting our institutions. And so now, if you have, as we did with the Mātauranga Māori issue, with the Listener 7 in 2021, if you have eminent Māori scholars saying Mātauranga Māori is not the same thing as science, well, they're the wrong type of Māori, and they have no right to speak there, and they need to be shunned. In fact, they were threatened with being expelled. They were fellows of the Royal Society, an auspicious position, and they were threatened with expulsion. If the Free Speech Union hadn't worked alongside them, it's quite possible they would have been expelled. We have many other instances like that where as we started off here, these rules are now being set out, and it's called freedom of expression policy. But in reality, it is more of a policy of what you're not free to express. And there's a real irony that the freedom of expression policy starts. The first thing it says is that the University of Auckland is committed to the Treaty of Waitangi, its principles, and biculturalism in New Zealand. So let's just be clear before we say anything about what rights you have to contribute to scholarly debate and to express yourself freely. Let's just be really clear with what you're not allowed to say first. And so that's one issue that
it's immediate. It's immediate conditions. And then, you know, both you and I know history. This is akin to the universities in the Middle Ages, which had to conform to a degree, in fact, some of them, to what the church taught. I'm not trying to drag us into deep church history, but, you know, you had to keep orthodox within a Christian tradition. You couldn't move away from it. And it's only over time we've sort of separated from that. Actually, dissent, challenging is welcome. But to me, Jonathan, it's almost as if we're putting the new dogma, or what Auckland Uni's trying to do with this draft expression, is put its own dogma. And I mean, if someone wants to have a different view on the treaty, there's one really healthy place for it. Well, actually two. One's Parliament, and two is our universities. But yeah, they're trying to control it. Deeply concerning.
And you know, there are if there are the 12 statements of faith in the Christian tradition, there are at least five in the new woke tradition, and they are that our Earth is imminently about to be destroyed by climate change, and you can't suggest anything to the otherwise. Whether that's true or not, I'll let others decide, but let's have the conversation that COVID-19 was the greatest pandemic threat, and that the only way we could respond to it was through mass vaccination, and anyone disagreeing was jeopardizing their nana's life. That race relations is a defining question of our time, and that you're a neo-colonialist and a racist if you disagree with the Treaty of Waitangi. That transgender genocide is occurring, and if you mispronounce someone, you are responsible if they take their life. And that Gaza is being overrun by apartheid colonialists, and that Israel is an ethno-nationalist state that needs to be brought to heel. These are kind of the five tropes, the five sacred cows that we are constantly coming up against. And the reason I know them so well, Simon, the reason I have them to mind is because we are having to deal with them every day. And people say, well, why aren't you ever defending people who are claiming that climate change is an existential crisis? Why aren't you ever defending them from being censored? Well, because no one's trying to censor them. Why aren't you ever standing up for the voices of transgender people who are being silenced? Well, we haven't come across any evidence to think that's existing. Why aren't you defending the Māori perspective on the race relations question? The reason this is so consistent, Simon, and what's really telling is as we bring in people like Jonathan Rauch from the United States and Toby Young from the UK and Jacob Nshangama from Denmark, they are dealing with the exact same questions. There's something about our moment in time around the world where we're not dealing with different questions. They have slightly different iterations, but they are the same fundamental questions. And I think they come out of the same neo-Marxist perspective.
Oh, it's globally linked. And it is globally linked. I mean, what we are suffering here in the attacks of free speech are being echoed in other parts of the world. I interviewed for a podcast, a Dr. Joanna Howe. In her case, she's a pro-lifer. But she's now taking her university to court, effectively, because she...
Which university is this?
University of Adelaide. So she's an Australian. So you can stand down, you can relax. We'll leave that to the Aussies. But, you know, there's just another example of, in this case, a Rhodes Scholar, Oxford-trained woman who holds...
You said rogue scholar.
To them, they will think she's rogue, but just constantly harassed. But one of her key points is that no one with the countervailing view is being harassed, period. And it's just like, it's this madness. But again, the Auckland University is clearly trying to entrench their view. But we were talking just before the show started, you've got issues, is it Massey University or Vic Uni as well?
Take your pick. I've just spent my day trawling through 600 pages almost of an OIA document. We released this earlier in the week as we discussed the ongoing saga around the free speech panel that was held there at the end of May. And I don't, you know, Simon, we hope springs eternal. We always have to have the aspiration that things can be better. One of my great joys of having in the past worked a bit alongside Sir Bill English is his eternal optimism, and I've tried to emulate that. But you know, you have the hope that your opponents maybe are operating in good faith, and that the differences are differences of communication and emphasis, not fundamental differences. And then, as I refer to material like the material that we've worked with this week, it shows that that's not the case. That our universities are in crisis point. That it is very clear. While they did abide me on that panel, which ended up being an utter waste of time, all things considered, the only reason they kept me there, they would have been very happy to drop me like a hot rock, except, and I take some solace in this, except the fact that they knew if they did that, they would provoke such a reaction from the 100,000 supporters of the Free Speech Union, it wasn't worth the hassle. They were more afraid of us than they were afraid of the people calling for me, begging for me to be excluded. And if they won't love me, I'll at least have them fear me. And it's not about me, of course, but about the free speech champions across this country who insist that the elites are not empowered. They do not have the right to pick and choose which opinions we get to interact with. And while avoiding long church history or whatever it is, I think we can reduce, Simon, the story of free speech to a story of individuals who have power wanting to shut out those who don't. And this is why it's so farcical that people claim that free speech marginalizes and victimizes the vulnerable in our society. Let's accept for a moment our opponent's narrative that as straight white men, we are necessarily imbued with privilege and that we have nothing to worry about in life because we're straight white men. And that's the only reason we believe in free speech. Well, at that point, why would we care about free speech? We've got privilege. We've got power. We don't need this radical idea in society that we should be free to speak even if others disagree, because we are top of the food chain. Surely it's only those who are excluded from power and shut out of privilege that benefit from this radical idea that even they should get to express themselves freely.
Oh, look, their view just is utterly, utterly dangerous. It's one of the reasons I call this show Speak Free and have guests like yourself and others on. It's to keep teasing out ideas and allowing people to have a voice, because actually there's a very small number of people but have captured our institutions by and large. I would argue with such weak views that the only way they can hold them is to force the silence of others. And worrying too, Jonathan, I think we probably talked about this offline years back, is they've also made the moral move from your view is wrong to you are wrong. And it's a very dangerous, if you will, philosophical step to make.
I think it's a fundamental shift from a modern view, which is based in reason, to a postmodern view. The modern view says I'm right and you're wrong and you're a bloody stupid fool for it, actually, and I'm going to tell you why. And that's why there were so many great debates and conversations in a previous generation, because individuals were eager to show why their perspectives were stronger than others. And that has morphed in my generation to not I'm right and you're wrong, but I'm good and you're bad. And rather than inviting conversation, now for me to hear your opinions, I would be contaminated by your perspective. I would become unclean. And it is resorting actually to a very old way of thinking of I can't associate, I can't hear from, I can't be seen with those who don't have the right ways of thinking. And the implications are extreme and the cost comes very quickly. It doesn't take a long time for that to have a very profound effect within our society. And I would suggest we are in the early stages of having to pay that piper. The early stages where we can still avoid calamity, but we need to be quick about it, I think.
The irony too, harking a little bit back to the Chloe Swarbuck hypocrisy, is that a lot of the people who are causing this corrosion, who are trying to cancel, de-platform, harass people of different views, are also the ones who talk a big game about social cohesion and community. So, we should end on a positive. You've had some success with the Marlborough Council, who tried to stop stop a group coming to talk about the protection of children. You've had some success. So tell us about that quickly.
Well, that's
because we
right.
should let and you be free to speak to others.
Simon, I one of the greatest privileges of my life is to lead the team that I do. We have some passionate, talented people that work in our team, and they have done an amazing job across a number of successes recently. One of them that your listeners, I think, will be particularly interested in is with the Marlborough District Council, a group called Let Kids Be Kids. And if ever there was an innocuous name, I think it would be Let Kids Be Kids. Maybe they're nefarious below that, but on that face level, it's quite controversial. And the library at Marlborough District Council said that it would seem, they didn't even really take the bother to ascertain, but it would seem that your group does not meet our criteria to be inclusive, and so we're not going to give you a meeting room because you're not an inclusive group. And the long and the short of it, Simon, is we went to them and said, look, that's not on, we'll see you in court because we have a very strong case and we won't tolerate this. We had a sit down, and ever wanting to check my own bias and wanting to learn from others, I said to their general counsel, I sat down with the mayor of Marlborough and their chief executive and their general counsel, and I said, look, and from my perspective, we have a very open shut case here. The law is very clear. You can't do this and we will see you for damages. And I would be interested, do you have a different perspective? And he didn't even try and proffer a defense. He said, no, the law is very clear. And so they were very eager to settle out of court. We insisted on three remedies to address the situation. They agreed to all three. We got a public apology from the council for refusing to accept the booking and a commitment that they would accept any booking from Let Kids Be Kids in the future. We received an invitation from the chief executive to come and host an educational seminar with his staff to explain why free speech matters and why local representatives and their staff need to respect it. And the third was within a month, that policy that they used to shut out Let Kids Be Kids will be amended to make sure that they can't discriminate on ideological grounds again in the future. So all round, I think, was a relatively resounding success.
Oh, I'd say so. Look, it's fantastic. It's sad, isn't it? We've touched on this a little bit. It's sad that this has to happen. But, you know, we're grateful you're there. The work that you and the free speech leading, I know Penny and the team at Let Kids Be Kids will be thrilled, but also you're leading it's a vanguard action, I might use a phrase a vanguard action to protect other groups to be able to go and actually hold their views and have their discussions. Jonathan, I am so grateful you've made this time to come and chat with me and the listeners, and look forward to having you on the show again soon.
Thanks very much, Simon.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.